I want you to turn back to the book of Job this morning. I'm going to go back. I was there last Sunday, and I want to spend a little more time here. I told, I think on several occasions, I've mentioned to you the fellow that decided to preach through the book of Isaiah years ago. This is back in the pre-colonial days in England. One of the old preachers in England decided he would preach through the book of Isaiah before he died and spent, if I'm not incorrect, 12 years in the first chapter. There is a wealth in the scripture, and last week we spent some time in Job, and I, even before the message was over, was reminded of some other things that I would like to say. I'm not going to preach the same message, although most of you wouldn't remember it if I did. It would all be brand new to you. But I mentioned last week Job being a book of questions. And 188 questions asked in the book of Job, or by Job in the book. And going through difficulty often brings us to that place of questions. And I mentioned some of those things last week in chapter 1. I want to move over to chapter number 3 this morning and deal with probably the most difficult word in the English language to explain, or explain away, or all of those things put together. I think that the word we will look at this morning has never been very far from a disaster. Never been very far from a heartache. Never been very far. As a matter of fact, I think it is the word that probably echoes from the walls of hell on a continuing basis. And it is certainly one of the words that will come to mind in face of a disaster, as it does in Job's situation. And having said last week that there is an adversary that watches us, and there is a God who watches us, and then there's a trusted friend who watches us, I want to deal with this word this morning. It is without a doubt the most difficult word I've had to deal with in my ministry. I think this morning, if I had to, I could probably give you about 40 minutes worth of deliberation on words like propitiation and justification and redemption and forgiveness and all of those theological terms and what the scripture has to say. I think I could probably help you to leave with an understanding about some of those difficult words in scripture. I'm not sure I can do that with the word that we'll deal with this morning. Sometimes it defies explanation. But I want to do my best this morning in a sense of helping you before you are at a place where this word leaps to the forefront of your mind and your circumstances. Now that I've got your attention, look at Job chapter number 3. And recognizing that Job has found his place on the ground, with his health gone and all of his possessions taken away. Now, last week we ended at the end of the book. I want you to blot that out of your mind for a few minutes. I want you to forget that he gets his children back. I want you to forget that he gets all of his lands and all of his cattle back. Can you do that? Can you kind of move back to this place right now where the disaster has just unfolded in his life? And as we go into chapter 3, we find that Job curses his day. That explains the weight of the tragedy that has happened to him. He curses his day in the sense that he loathes the day that he was even born. We sometimes use phrases and words that don't have any meaning to us. If we thought about them, we wouldn't use them. But the Bible says here that Job cursed the day he was born, and Job is not just somehow grasping for words and saying things he doesn't mean. Job has every understanding of what he's saying here, and he, if no one else ever has been able to, could honestly say it had been better if I'd never been born because of where he is at this moment. But Job asks a question here again, and five times in this chapter he uses this word I want to deal with this morning, beginning in verse number 11. Why? Died I not from the womb? Why? Did I not give up the ghost when I came out of the belly? Why did the knees prevent me? Or why the breasts that I should suck. Look over in verse 23 and see it for the last time. Why is light given to a man whose way is hid and whom God hath hedged in? I want to talk to you about the word this morning, why. Why? You'd think a word that was so simple in its construction, only three letters, would be an easy word to explain. But it is probably the word that has accompanied more grief and tear and heartache and woe than any other word in the English language. It has probably been there as a backdrop of virtually every tear of grief and sadness that has been shed. It has certainly gone to pretty much every graveside and every funeral that I've ever been at in my life. Even those who are elderly and have passed out of this life, having lived a full and fruitful life, even in that lifespan, as we near the graveside to put away a body of one we've known for such a long time, you'll hear that word because it always is there. It's always there when somehow nothing else can find a place, when no other word will do, when some words are not invited. Why is always there. It is probably the word that a preacher or a pastor deals with more than any other word that he ever comes across. If the King's English is to be spoken, then I would have to say that this little three-letter word, why, is probably the most powerful of any words that we ever use. Because it catches our attention very quickly. Because even when we're not vocalizing the word, very often there is in our heart that word, why. Why? Why? It is a word that grows more intense with repetition. I have been in places where that was all that somebody said or cried or sobbed for a long, long time. Strung together just one after another. Why? 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 It is a word, I promise you, that you will become familiar with in the course of a lifetime. It is not a word that I can say you are immune from, that you will never use, but I promise you, one and all, that there will be a day, a time, a place, a circumstance where that word will come to you readily. And the sad thing is that very often when it comes to mind and when it comes from our lips, there follows it just silence. Because it is such a difficult word. We can find opinions that are very often offered in the context of why, but very, very, very rarely is there an answer that can be given. The Bible said, I think very aptly for those of us that have that urge to sometimes be more of a help than we can be, and sometimes need to just shut up. The Scripture said, laugh with them that laugh, and weep with them that weep. Simply put, you don't have an answer. There's nothing you can say to correct this circumstance. There is no fix. There is no imparting of strength. This is a time that is totally in a vacuum. And that's when this word comes so freely. Why? Why? Had you been there when Job began his questioning, you might have, as a good Baptist brother or sister, sit down and say, well, now let me tell you some things, Job, and you might have, but they would have been from your limited experience, having known nothing of what Job has just dealt with. Sometimes we look at it as though it is unbelief and lack of faith. And maybe when you go through that, you'll remember that you thought that and realize how foolish you were. Sometimes people carry burdens greater than they can bear. Sometimes people deal with circumstances far beyond what their capacity to deal with happens to be. And sometimes it would do well for those of us who stand by as onlookers to just shut up and not try to answer questions that cannot be answered. Job asks 5 times in 1 chapter, why? 16 times in this book you'll find him asking, or someone asking, why? And I promise you, if you're over the age of 20, you've heard someone ask in the course of their tragedy, why? No answers. No answers. Let me say in fairness, it is not always just the backdrop of a tragic situation. Sometimes the word why simply is an expression of immaturity. If you have a child, you learn that they learn that word first. Dada, mama, why? That's usually the way it works, and sometimes not even in that order. A child is always wanting to know why about the simplest of things in our estimation. Why? And on it seems to go. And that's not an expression of tragedy in their life. It's an expression of the lack of knowledge. They're inquisitive. They want to learn. Thank God that He gave us that opportunity as children and not as old people. Can you imagine having to deal with a 40-year-old who just continually said, why? Can you imagine running a company where all of the employees showed up for work and began their day with why? Can you imagine pastoring a... Maybe that's not a good example. Sometimes why is simply an expression of immaturity. Sometimes it's an expression of rebellion. If you've raised one of those little children and they grow up and they become teenagers, they just change the way they say the word. Now it's why. Why? Why do I have to do that? Why everybody else gets to do it? Why do I have to do it? Why me? It's a statement of imagined persecution, as though the world is against them. And everybody knows when you turn 13, 14, or 15, the world turns against you. Everybody in the world hates you. They're all trying to destroy you and make sure that you never, ever, ever, ever again in the course of your life have one happy moment. Everybody knows that's the real reason God gave parents to children, to keep them from ever again being happy. It takes them about 12 or 13 years to realize it. But when they finally do realize it, they rise up in rebellion. They light the torches and storm the castle with the word, why? Why do I have to do it? Sometimes why is a statement of immaturity. Sometimes it's a statement of rebellion. Sometimes it is just a lack of knowledge. It doesn't go away when we reach maturity, and we still do, even as old guys, ask why every once in a while. Now, I'm hoping it's not in rebellion, and I'm hoping it's not in childlike simplicity, but sometimes it just doesn't make sense. Sometimes things just don't make sense, no matter how old you are. They don't add up. We live in a world that is bound and determined to convince us that 2 + 2 = 5. And I'm sorry, you know, call me an old codger if you want to, but it doesn't. 2 + 2 = 5. Okay? Our world, you say, well, you know, preacher, you're always harping about the world going in the wrong direction. Why? There's a good question. I'll tell you why. Because 2 + 2 = 5. And I realize there's some awfully smart fools sitting around various places in our country today that have control in the helm. But I'm just going to tell you, 2 + 2 = 5. It never has and it never will. But sometimes there is a lack of understanding. And sometimes out of respect, I ask someone why. Because I want to know. I want to understand. I want to grasp whatever it is that you're trying to explain. I don't have enough information yet. I don't see it your way, but I give you an opportunity. Why would you do that? Why would you say that? Why would you think that? Sometimes it is a lack of strength for the things that we have to bear. And that's what I'm looking at this morning. I've dealt with enough grief in my ministry to know that very often why means simply, I can't carry this. I can't bear this. Why is not some stubborn, rebellious statement. It's not even asking for more information. Sometimes it's, I just can't carry this load. And why seems to be the most reasonable expression of that overwhelming feeling. It has friends, and sometimes those friends in this circumstance, as I said a moment ago, are tears. They like to accompany this word that has to bear all of this grief and sorrow and suffering or whatever it might be. But whatever it is, that's completely overwhelming. Why? And then come the tears. I guess I've probably been asked that question on 1,000 occasions. And I don't think it has ever come with any preparedness on my part. You'd think that you'd sit down at home before you left home and you'd say, okay, now here's what they're going to say. And when they say that, here's what I'm going to say. And I'll be honest with you, the ministry is full of what I would call pat answers. Not just that we're trying to set something aside or make light of it, but very often, because we very often deal with the same circumstances and go through the same problems and deal with the same issues in life, there are pat answers. What the answer to your question might be the answer to that question over there. Sometimes I think that we may sound almost as though we don't care because, well, I heard you tell them that. That's what I'm trying to say. Your circumstances are very much like theirs, and what worked in their circumstance will work in your circumstance. But this one of overwhelming grief and sadness and suffering and sorrow, I don't have a pat answer for that. I don't understand. I have preached funerals that should not have been. Circumstances that should never have come about. Brother Andre got saved last Sunday morning, and he told me the first time I came to your church was when you preached Brother Peace's grandson's funeral. Just a little casket at that funeral. Just a tiny little box. Can I give you a good word for that? Why? Why does it have to be that way? Why do things like that happen? I don't understand. I don't have a pat answer. I can't put my arm around a sobbing, weeping parent or grandparent or brother or sister and say, well, let me tell you what's going on here, and that'll take care of that. It doesn't take care of it. Sometimes the right answer doesn't take care of the why. Sometimes why is not seeking any information at all. Sometimes why is just trying to get a breath of air and man up so you can carry the load a little further. Job said, why? Why am I here? Why did God do this? Why does this have to happen? Why my kids? I can think of 1,000 things that Job thought about, all of which began with the word why. Sometimes these questions, they have fascinated me for some time here in the book of Job. I like it when something sticks in your mind and God keeps bringing you back to a book or a chapter or a verse and continually shows you another aspect. I think every word and every verse and every book in a Bible is like a multifaceted gem. That you can look at it from here and see the sparkle, but as soon as you turn it, the light shines differently and you see it completely in a different way. And every verse, every word is that way. And may I say, every question has a meaning. Job said, why? Well, let me tell you, I don't know how to answer the question. But I know how to tell you to answer the question when you ask it. Does that make any sense? It's not the question that I have an answer for, but I can tell you how you can find the answer for that question when it comes into your life, because I don't know how it will come, but I know it will come. I don't know what will bring it, and I don't know whether it will be sorrow or tragedy or discomfort or disease or whatever it will be. I don't know, but I know how to tell you how to find the answer or the satisfaction that is needed to get through a why time. First of all, I have to not worry about why, but who. Who is in control will help you figure out why. Who is in control? Sometimes we think that, you know, this just happened. It was just happenstance and just unusual things. But there's too many coinkydinkies in life for me to believe that there's not somehow a master controller behind all of it. We could spend the rest of the day today just going around and allowing a couple of minutes for everybody to talk about one of those unusual set of circumstances. The times that I was delayed for a minute going here or there, or the phone rang as I was leaving the parking lot, and so I had to sit there and answer the call, and didn't drive 2 minutes down the road and here's four cars in an accident, and the Holy Spirit kind of tap you on the shoulder and say, this is why you needed to take that call. How many times have you come to a place where you said, thank God you're in control, because I could have been here. I could have been part of this. This tragedy could have been about me instead of about me watching someone else's tragedy. How many times could we have died, and how many times should we have died had it not been for God's directing hand in our life? Someone said before in jest, but I think it probably provable truth, that if there were no God, you would know it because no one would live beyond the age of 3. Somebody said, prove to me there's a God. Here's a 4-year-old. What more proof do you need? Think of how many ways a child could kill itself in its early days and how many ways it tries. We could, everyone, stand up and talk about something foolish and stupid we did or learned to do as just a small child. Miraculous that no one died. I think about my brother and I, and we love each other enough to fight with each other tooth and nail. My little brother has become my big brother. And he works overseas, and so he looks like an Arab now. He's got the big beard, and if he puts one of those hats on, you'd think that he had come to send you to Allah. But I think about how many ways we could have killed each other. I mean, just rambunctious, crazy kids. And it is a miracle of God that we survived. You say, what are you saying? I'm saying when I confront that why circumstance, I need to kind of take my mental eraser out and erase the why. And in its place, I simply need to write, who controls my life? Who brought me here? You say, well, what does that do? Well, I'm going to tell you what, when you're looking at a tragedy or a grief or a sorrow or a pain or a hurt that won't even allow you to see clearly through the tears that flow from your eyes, there is no answer to why, but there is a comfort in knowing that I know who brought me here. I know who's in control of my life. Years ago, none of you were here then when this church was just in its infancy. There was a piano player that played the piano for us, and maybe a couple of you would remember her. But she had a very rare condition. That condition would not allow her body to form kidney stones. It did not harden, but her kidneys filled with the sludge of which kidney stones are made of. And rather than getting the stabbing pain that many of you felt when you were passing a kidney stone, she felt that pain constantly, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I talked to her on many occasions and said, how you doing? And before she opened her mouth, the tears would begin to roll down her face. I said, I don't understand how you deal with that. Can I say this morning, I'm sure she asked the Lord sometimes, why, don't you think? But you know what she told me one time? She said, preacher, she said, I have to look at it this way. Nothing ever comes into my life without passing through the hands of a heavenly Father that loves me and cares for me. Therefore, everything in my life is a result of His love and His care for me. And she said, that's the only way
I can carry what I carry. You see, it's not a question of give me adequate answers. It's a question of who's in control. We come through life, we lay plans out, we have dreams, we see things, we want them to go a certain way, we anticipate this and that. And sometimes when we've expected the greatest happiness that there can be, there comes sadness and sorrow in its place. And that word why always shows up on the doorstep. May I say to you, I think sometimes why is the devil's word because it never comes with any clarity at all. But at that moment when it takes its residence in our life, we would do well, I think, to say first of all, who, not why, who is in control of my life? And then I think secondly, when the word why arrives on our doorstep, to just taunt and plague us, because that's all the word does. It taunts us. It makes fun of us. It ridicules us. When we try to get up, it pushes us back down again and again and again and again. Sometimes I need to consider, wait a minute, not why, but who is in control. And secondly, not why, but what is he trying to accomplish in my life? Not only who's in control, I know that wherever I am, God has allowed it to be so, good or bad. I know that God has directed my steps. I know that He has led the way. And if there be tragedy here in my life, He is the author of that tragedy as readily as He would have been the author of whatever good, wonderful thing might have happened. I have to receive it as from God. But the second question that I deal with is not why, but what is He going to accomplish in this? Job said later on, He knoweth the way that I take. And when I am tried, I shall come forth as gold. You know what Job recognized about his why? Was not only was God in control, but God had a plan. I think it was Moses that gave Israel instruction that God didn't bring us here into the wilderness to kill us. When they thought that everything was a mess and that they were asking the question, why? And why didn't we stay in Egypt? And why are we here? He simply relays to them, God has a plan and you're in the wilderness because God has a plan. And yes, God orchestrated it. God allowed it to happen, but it wasn't haphazard. He has a plan, and that plan is going to work out far better than you ever could imagine. What is His plan? Let me ask you the question. Have you ever been able to see the end of your tragedies? In the sense of sometimes the clarity we have when we look back. May I say this morning, and without any hesitancy at all, some of us would never have become the people God allowed us to become if there hadn't been that tragedy that we've never forgotten in our life. That day you were joyriding down the highway of life without a care in the world, and all at once you hit the wall at 90 miles an hour and you said, what in the world, God? Why is this happening? God had a plan you were completely unaware of. Completely unaware of. And now that you've come down the road a little bit and you can look back, you can say, man, you know, God's pretty smart. Oh, you say, I always knew that. I bet you didn't. I bet there are times you questioned. I bet there are times you might have been so bold as to tell Him He didn't even know what He was doing. I'll bet there are probably times you probably told Him you knew more than He did. I hope you've apologized since then. When you realize that the goodness of God may take you down some dark and lonely places, but only to bring you back up again on the other side of the mountain where the flowers grow and the sun shines so bright and the weather is so much better. And you'd have never gotten to that side of the mountain had you not gone down through that valley. Sometimes God allows us to go down through that valley of why, simply so that we can see the wonder of His plan for us. I don't know that any of us would have ever just fallen in lockstep with God's plan for our life had He revealed it to us at the beginning. I remember, and I've given you the testimony, so I won't bore you with it this morning. I ran from God's call to preach in my life for better than a year. I said no. I said it emphatically. I said it with great meaning. I do not want to be a preacher. Had other plans, had other designs that filled my mind. And I promised, well, I said, I'm not going to be a heathen. I'm not going to be an atheist. I just want to do what I want to do. And if you'll let me do what I want to do, I'll tell everybody how wonderful you are. What a great statement that was. Somehow God wasn't wonderful unless He let me do what I wanted to do. And He continued to persist. And I continued to resist when he was in the midst of his persistence. And I think one day he pulled back the curtains, and I remember it as vividly as if I were there at this moment. He pulled back the curtains and he said, okay. And he showed me all the kingdoms of this world, I think. At least whatever it was that I thought I was going to gain in doing what I wanted to do. And he said, there you are. And then this thought entered my mind. I don't know that I heard God speak audibly. I'm not trying to give you some type of a spiritual thought here. But I know God spoke to me and He said, I'll get someone else that'll do what I want them to do. And for the first time in my life, I realized that to get what I wanted, I had to give up what He wanted. To get what I could gain, I had to lose what He would give me. And for the first time, I think, in my whole life, my heart broke when I realized how much I needed Him and His plan for my life. Young people, don't miss God's plan for your life. You can go a long way in this world. You can accomplish a lot. But don't get there only to find out that God had another direction that would have taken you so much further than you could have ever imagined. When you find yourself in that situation where you want to go a certain way to a certain college or marry a certain individual and God puts down His hand of resistance and says, no, that's not. Before you cry out, why? Maybe ask the question, God, what do You have for me then? Because it must be better than this. The Bible said, no good thing will He withhold from them that walk uprightly. So if He says no to this, that means there's something better in another direction. I need to recognize, I need to realize that sometimes the word why is not the word I need to use. Sometimes the question needs to be not why is this happening, but who is in control of my life? And what does He have for me to do? And then let me give you another thought when the word why comes. You say, well, preacher, you know, what about this tragedy? Listen, when a loved one dies, God's in control. We had that funeral I mentioned too. I don't understand why God would allow a 2-3-year-old to be taken from this world. But I know this, He did. I know He did. You say, well, I don't believe God do that. People ask all the time stupid questions, you know. You know, well, how do you know there's a God? If there was a God, why are there wars going on? I tell you why there are wars going on, because there's stupid people in the world. Okay? You know, getting rid of God. Listen, you'd think that if atheism was true, that the more atheists we got, the less wars we'd fight. Right? If all of the bloodshed around the world is a result of Christians causing war, then, man, we ought to be at perfect peace right now in America. I mean, our president announced 2 years ago, we are not a Christian nation. First time in the history of our country that statement was made. The atheists are rising up to celebrate the occasion, and boy, what a mess. You say, well, what do you think? I think the problem is the fact that somehow we just got warped somewhere in our thinking. God is in control when a loved one dies. God's in control when we don't understand why it was them and not us, or why it was them and perhaps not someone who was aged and diseased, and why they continue lingering. And I'm not trying to make sense other than to say at that moment, the only thing that will make sense of it is who's in control. And then secondly, He has a plan. He knows what He's doing. And then thirdly, He knows how this story is going to end. He knows how this story is going to end. Sometimes we look yonder to heaven in our days of deepest grief, and it seems as though heaven's laughing at us. As though God doesn't care. And sometimes it's almost as though you can look up and see Him smiling, and you think, why are you? But see, He's not smiling about your calamity. He's smiling because He knows the end of the story. You know what we like to do in America? We like to watch the same movies over and over and over and over again. I don't want you to raise your hands, but how many of you have ever watched the same movie for the fourth time? I told you not to raise your hands. Why in the world would we waste another hour watching something that sometimes we watch them back to back? It's over. Let's watch it again. And I'm sure you'd agree with me, sometimes it's better the second time through because we know how it's going to end. How many of you have ever watched a movie with somebody that's already seen it and wanted to kill them? Because they want to let you know, oh, don't worry, don't cry. No, 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 you just don't. I know how it ends. You see, there's something about knowing how it ends that can guide you through some of those difficult spots. When the hero's tied to the railroad track and train's coming down the track and he can't get away and woe is me and alas, the hero is about to die. It always is a pain to have somebody sitting on a couch. Oh, no, no, don't worry about it. He gets away. I want you to tell me that. But you see, there's an insight to having seen the movie because you know how it's going to end. You know what God knows? On your worst day and in the midst of your greatest tears and grief, and when you look sometimes even in anger at the God who loves you more than anybody who ever has, and you look at Him and in anger you say, why? And He seems like He's smiling. Don't be fooled. He just knows how the story ends. And He's not going to tell you because then it wouldn't be exciting. So He just sits there with that divine grin on His face as if to say, just wait. Let it take its course. You see, things are not, I started to say, not always what they seem. May I say it a different way? Rarely are they what they seem. I could spend the rest of your day today giving you examples, and I won't, but I'll give you some that I like to use. Thomas Alva Edison. We know the name. We know the name. We know that he was a great inventor. We may not know what he invented, and rightly so, because he invented, I don't remember, several thousand patents, I think, that he held at one time. We know him as the father of the electric light bulb. If you were to journey up the road here to one of those places, museums up there, you'd find his workshop and they would tell you the story. I've heard it several times that there on the second floor where he worked on the light bulb, he would try one and every time he would throw current to it, it would burn out or blow up. And they said he would very patiently take it out of the fixture that he had put it in, walk over to the window and toss it out the window. And he would always tell his people, we have just discovered another way not to make a light bulb. By the time he discovered the secret to an electric light, they say that there was a pile of discarded failures as high as his second floor window. Persistence, yes. Brilliance, yes. Great mind, yes. Great inventor, yes. Did you know that when Edison first went to school, that within just a couple of days of beginning his education, the teacher sent young Thomas home with a note. The note was addressed to his mother, and it said in roundabout ways this, maybe directly if I remember correctly, I regret to inform you that your son is beyond education. He has no comprehension. He cannot piece together the simplest of facts. He is totally void of any ability to learn. Now I'm going to ask you a question. What do you think Mrs. Edison said to God? Yeah. Why? And what do you think God did? He just smiled. He said, "You haven't got any idea." Did it make her life any better? Probably not, but maybe it just pestered the fire out of her like it does us sometimes. But she just yielded to God's plan, and her son's name will probably live another 300-400 years if humans last that long. I'll give you another name and we'll go. Enrico Caruso. If you like music, you'll know Enrico Caruso. He was probably, without a doubt, and if not, then very near Pavarotti as the greatest opera singer who ever lived. His records are the old flat plastic kind that kind of when they play now. But even at that, his records today command a tremendous price. People who want to have them. So what are you saying, preacher? I'm saying this. When his mother first began to raise that little boy, she said, "I've always wanted to have an opera singer yonder in Italy." And so she contacted a fellow in the town who was an opera singer in his own right. And she said, "I want you to train my son to sing." And she sent little Enrico down there, and he sent him back home and said, "Madam," he said, "in all of my days of training singers, I have never met one who was truly, absolutely tone deaf. But," he said, "your son is tone deaf." You say, what does that mean? Well, in our language, we say he couldn't carry a tune in a bucket. Wasn't going to happen. But don't you suppose when she got that word that she longed for an opera star that was never going to be, don't you suppose she looked yonder to heaven? What do you suppose she said? Why? What do you suppose God did? He smiled. Why? Because he didn't care? Oh no, he cared profoundly. But he didn't want to spoil it for them. See, it was their first time through. He wanted them to hang on every moment of suspense and excitement in this life that we have. And so he sat there knowing the end of the story and didn't say a word. But he smiled. Now I say to you, sometimes when you deal with the whys of life, maybe you just need to put that question aside because there's never a satisfaction for that question. But you can ask yourself the question, wait a minute, who is in control of my life and circumstances? Who brought me here to this sad place or this tragic place? And what is his plan as it moves away from this in the direction of the future? And then, what's the end of this story going to be all about? If he who is in control of my life and has brought me here, if his plan is for my good and if his plan is for my joy and for my happiness, joy unspeakable, full of glory. Look at the words the apostles use to talk about a Christian's life. There's never any sad, morose type verbiage there. It's always rejoice in the Lord. Again, I say rejoice. Be happy in the Lord. Does that indicate somehow a God who is sadistic in his nature? Or does it maybe indicate that you're just not far enough down the road in the plan to recognize what God's going to do in the course of your life? Dr. Hiles wrote a poem years ago, and it's always been a help, I suppose, to me. I would use that word. And describing his ministry, and I'll read it to you this morning, and then I'll turn you loose. Because the title of the poem simply is why. I've sat beside a tiny crib and watched a baby die as parents slowly turned to me to ask, "Oh, Pastor, why?" I've held the youthful husband's head and felt death's heave and sigh. A widow looked through tears and said, "Dear Pastor, tell me why." I've seen a gold star mother weep and hold a picture nigh her lonely breast and softly ask, "Why, Pastor, why, oh why?" I've walked away from baby land where stillborn babies lie. A mother stretches empty arms and asks me, "Pastor, why?" I've watched my drunken father leave our home and say goodbye. While looking into mama's face, I ask, "Please tell me why." I've heard the white-tipped cane, white-tipped tapping cane, which leads a blinded eye. And then a dark and lonely voice cries, "Preacher, show me why." I've caught a fiancé's burning tears and heard her lonely cry. She held an unused wedding gown and shouted, "Pastor, why?" I've heard the cancer patient say, "'Tis gain for me to die," then looked into his daughter's face and mutely whisper, "Why?" I've seen a father take his life. A widow stands nearby as little children say, "Dear Mom, the preacher will tell us why." I've seen my mother stand beside two tiny graves and cry, and though she'd never let me know, I knew she wondered why. I've heard an orphan faintly say who gazed into the sky, "Though Mom and Dad have gone away, my preacher, he'll know why." I tiptoed to my father's throne, so timid and so shy, to say, "Dear God, some of your own are wanting to know why." I heard him say so tenderly, "Their eyes I'll gladly dry. They must look through faith today. Tomorrow they'll know why. If now they find the reasons that their hopes have gone awry, in heaven they'll miss the joy of hearing me tell them why." And so I found it pleases him when I can testify. I'll trust my God to do what's best and wait to find out why. Job said, "Why?" But the truth is, there's someone in control of your life. And in love and care, he's brought you to this place. And he has a plan that will take you beyond this place. And when all is said and done, his plan ends with a happy ending.